Chapter 56 Suma was growing more angry and impatient by the moment. Diaz and Smith never seemed to tire of quarreling with him, giving vent to their hatred of his achievements, threatening him as if he was a common thief off the street. He came to welcome the chance to wash his hands of them. Abducting Senator Diaz, he felt, was a mistake. He took him only because Ichiro Tsuboi was confident that Diaz carried substantial influence in the Senate and held the president's ear. Suma saw the man as petty and narrow-minded. After a medical discharge from the army, Diaz had worked his way through the University of New Mexico. He then used the traditional road to power by becoming a lawyer and championing causes that brought headlines and support from the majority state party. Suma despised him as an obsolete political hack who harped on the monotonous and tiresome harangue of taxing the rich for welfare programs to feed and house non-working poor. Charity and compassion were traits Suma refused to accept. Congresswoman Smith, on the other hand, was a very astute woman. Suma had the uncomfortable feeling she could read his mind and counter any statement he tossed at her. She knew her facts and statistics and could quote them with ease. Lauren came from good Western stock, her family having ranched the western slope of Colorado since the 1870s. Educated at the University of Colorado, she ran for office and beat an incumbent who had served for 30 years. She could play hardball with any man. Suma suspected that her only soft spot was Dirk Pitt, and he was closer to the truth than he knew. Suma stared across the table from them, sipping sake and regrouping for another exchange of harsh words. He was about to make another point when Toshie came into the room and whispered softly into his ear. Suma set his sake cup on the table and stood. "It's time for you to leave." Lauren elegantly came to her feet and locked eyes with Suma. "I'm not moving from here until I know Dirk and Al are alive and treated humanely." Suma smiled indulgently. "They covertly came onto foreign soil, my soil, as intelligence agents of a foreign country." "Japanese law is the same as ours in regards to espionage," she interrupted. "They're entitled to a fair trial." Suma gloated with malicious satisfaction. "I see little reason to carry this discussion further. By now, Mr. Pitt and Mr. Giordino, along with the rest of their spy team, have been executed by my friend Moro Kamatori. Make of it what you will." Lauren felt as if her heart had been crushed in ice. There was a stunned silence, made even more shocking at knowing it must be true. Her face went white, and she swayed on her feet, her mind suddenly void. Toshie grabbed Lauren's arm and pulled her toward the door. "Come, the aircraft that will take you to Edo City and Mr. Suma's private aircraft is waiting."
"No ride through your amazing tunnel beneath the sea?" asked Diaz without a hint of disappointment.
"There are some things I don't wish you to see," Suma said nastily. As if walking through a nightmare, Lauren uncaringly allowed Toshie to drag her through a foyer that opened onto a stone path that crossed over a small pond. Suma bowed and motioned for Diaz to accompany the women. Diaz shrugged submissively and limped with his cane ahead of Suma, while the two robo-guards brought up the rear. Beyond the pond, a sleek, tilt-turbine aircraft sat in the middle of a lawn surrounded by a high, neatly trimmed hedge. The jet engines were turning over with a soft, whistling sound. Two crewmen in red nylon flight suits and brimmed caps stood at attention on each side of the steps leading inside the main cabin. Both were short, one slim, the other fairly bursting the stitched seams over his shoulders. They respectfully bowed their heads as Suma's party approached. Diaz stopped suddenly. "When I return to Washington, I'm going to hold a news conference and expose you and your monstrous plans. Then I'll fight you with every means at my command in both houses of Congress until every asset you have in the United States is confiscated and nationalized. I won't rest until you pay for your crimes." Suma made an infuriating grin. "Our Washington lobbyists are more than strong enough to dilute your pathetic efforts. We own too many of your fellow legislators who have a weakness for hidden wealth for you to influence. Your voice will ring hollow, Senator Diaz. Your government, whether you like it or not, corrupt and mired in emotional programs instead of technology and science, has become a wholly owned Japanese subsidiary." Lauren leaned toward Suma, her eyes narrowing in scorn. "You underestimated American guts 50 years ago, and once again you've awakened a sleeping giant and filled him with terrible resolve. Admiral Yamamoto's words, 'after December the 7th, do not apply now," Suma said contemptuously. "Your people have lost the fortitude to make sacrifices for the good of the nation. You must face reality, Congresswoman Smith. America's greatness is gone. I have nothing more to say except to urge you to warn your president of Japan's intentions."
"Don't you mean your intentions?" said Lauren bravely, the color coming back into her face. "You don't represent the Japanese people."
"A safe journey home, Congresswoman Smith. Your visit has ended."
Suma turned and began to walk away, but he'd only taken one step when the two crewmen grabbed his arms from each side, lifted him off his feet, and hurled him backward through the open door into the aircraft's cabin, where he seemingly vanished. It all happened so fast that Lauren and Diaz stood in blank-minded shock. Only Toshiye reacted, lashing out with her foot at the heavier-built crewman. "Is this any way to begin an intimate relationship?" laughed Giordino, grabbing Toshiye's foot, sweeping her up in his arms, and hoisting her through the door to Weatherhill and Mancuso's waiting hands as easily as if she was filled with air. Lauren gasped and started to mutter something to Giordino, but Stacy brusquely pushed her up the short stairs. "No time to waste, Miss Smith. Please step lively." With Lauren on her way, she pulled at Diaz. "Get a move on, Senator. We've worn out our welcome."
Where did you all come from?" he stammered as Mancuso and Weatherhill hauled him through the hatch.
"Just your friendly neighborhood hijackers," Weatherhill answered conversationally. "Actually, it was Pitt and Giordino who got the drop on the crew and tied them up in the cargo compartment." Giordino lifted Stacy into the cabin and scrambled up the stairs after her. He threw a smart salute at the two robo-guards that aimed their weapons at him but stood in stationary bewilderment. "Sayonara, robo-turkeys!" He yanked the door shut and locked it. Then he turned and shouted one brief word in the direction of the cockpit. "Go!" The soft whistle of the two turbine engines increased to an ear-splitting shriek, and their thrust flattened the grass under the stubby wings. The wheels lifted from the damp ground, and the aircraft rose straight into the air, hung there for a few moments as the engines slowly twisted to a horizontal position, and then it shot off in a wide bank that took it over the sea toward the east. Lauren hugged Giordino.
"Thank God you're all right. Is Dirk with you?"
"Who do you think is driving the bus?" Giordino smiled broadly as he nodded toward the cockpit. Without another word, Lauren ran up the aisle and threw open the cockpit door. Pitt sat in the pilot's seat, heavily concentrating on flying an aircraft that was new to him. He didn't blink or turn his head as she slipped her hands around his neck and down inside his borrowed Suma Corporation flight suit and kissed him at least a dozen times.
"You're alive," she said joyfully. "Suma said you were dead."
"It hasn't exactly been a fun-filled day," Pitt managed between her kisses. "Does this mean you're glad to see me?" She lightly dragged her nails over his chest.
"Can't you ever get serious?"
"Lady, right now I'm about as serious as I can get. I've got 8 people depending on me to fly an aircraft I've never touched before. And I better get the hang of it real quick or we're all going body surfing."
"You can do it," she said confidently. "Dirk Pitt can do anything."
"I wish people wouldn't say that," Pitt groaned. He gave a quick tick of his head to his right. "Take the co-pilot's seat and play with the radio. We've got to call in the cavalry before the Samurai Air Force takes up the chase. No way we can outrun jet fighters."
"Suma doesn't own the Japanese military.
He owns everything else around here. I'm not taking any chances. Switch on the radio. I'll give you the frequency."
"Where are we going?"
"The Ralph R. Bennett."
"A boat?"
"A ship," Pitt corrected her. "A U.S. Navy detection and tracking ship. If we get to her before we're intercepted, we're home free."
"They wouldn't dare shoot us down with Hideki Suma on board."
Pitt's eyes flickered from the instrument panel to the water rushing by below. "Oh, how I hope you're right." Behind them, Giordino was trying but failing to soothe Toshiye, who was hissing and striking out like a hysterical cat. She spat at him but narrowly missed his cheek, catching him on the ear. Finally, he grabbed her from the rear and held her in a tight vice grip. "I realize I don't make a good first impression," he said happily, "but to know me is to love me."
"You Yankee pig!" she cried.
"Not so. My Italian ancestors would never admit to being Yankees." Stacy ignored Giordino and the struggling Toshiye and tightly bound Suma to one of several plush leather chairs in the luxurious executive main cabin. Disbelief was written all over his face. "Well, well, well," said a happy Mancuso. "Surprise, surprise, the big man himself came along for the ride."
"You're dead. You're all supposed to be dead," he muttered incredulously.
"Your buddy Kamatori is the one who's dead," Mancuso sadistically informed him.
"How?"
"Pitt stuck him on the wall." Pitt's name seemed to act as a stimulant. Suma came back on keel, and he said,
"You have made a disastrous mistake.
You will unleash terrible forces by taking me hostage." "Fair is fair. Now it's our turn to act mean and nasty." The human voice can't exactly imitate the hiss of a viper, but Suma came pretty close to it.
"You are too stupid to understand. My people will launch the Kaiten Project when they have learned what you've done."
"Let them try," Weatherhill fairly purred. "In about another 3 minutes, your Dragon Center is going to have its lights put out." The robotic electrical inspector, Otokodate, soon found the explosive charge taped to the ribbon of fiber optics. He deftly removed it and rolled back to his console. He studied the package for several moments, recognizing the timer for what it was, but his memory had not been programmed to analyze plastic explosives, and he had no concept of its purpose. He transmitted a signal to his superior in robotic control. "This is Otokodate at Power Center 5. "Yes, what is it?" answered a robot monitor. "I wish to communicate with my supervisor, Mr. Okuma. He is not back from tea yet. Why are you transmitting?" "I have found a strange object attached to the primary fiber-optic bundle."
"What sort of object?"
"A pliable substance with a digital timing device. Could be an instrument left behind by a cable engineer during installation."
"My memory does not contain the necessary data for a positive identification. Do you wish me to bring it to control for examination?"
"No, remain at your station. I'll send a courier down to collect it."
"I will comply."
A few minutes later, a courier robot named Nakajima that was programmed to navigate every passageway and corridor and pass through the doors to all office and work areas in the complex entered the power center. As ordered, Otokodate unwittingly turned over the explosive to Nakajima. Nakajima was a sixth-generation mechanical rover that could receive voice commands but not give them. It silently extended its articulated gripper, took the package, deposited it in a container, and then began the trip to robotic control for inspection. 50 meters from the power center door, at a point well removed from humans and critical equipment, the C-8 plastic detonated with a thundering roar that rumbled throughout the concrete passageways of Level 5. The Dragon Center was designed and built to withstand the most severe earthquakes, and any structural damage was minimal. The Kaiten project remained intact and operational. The only result of Weatherhill's explosive charge was the almost total disintegration of courier rover Nakajima.